Hello, and welcome to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. Are you interested in contributing content to LQ? We're always looking for members interested in writing articles, writing tutorials, submitting in-depth distribution reviews, and more. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, please contact us. A couple quick numbers updates on a couple of the major LQ projects. The LQ Wiki now has 2,862 articles, and it's well on its way to our target of 3,000. LQ ISO now has 370 distribution versions of 185 different distributions available for download from over 660 different mirrors. We've now facilitated 2,331,216 Linux ISO downloads. As for the forums themselves, 273,800 members have now made 489,886 threads that contain 2,458,013 posts. So those are some pretty big numbers there. LQ continues to see just phenomenal growth, and I'd like to thank each and every member for making LQ what it is. Now, on to the news. The first story I have is Microsoft on warding off the Linux threat. The hubris in this ZDNet interview is just astounding. While some people at Microsoft are certainly adapting to a shifting business landscape, and that's something I've covered in previous podcasts, Nick McGrath, who's Microsoft's head of platform strategy in the UK, is a shining example, I think, of what is wrong with the Microsoft corporate culture. Reading the interview, it becomes clear that factual information and reality are really of no concern. At times, I almost expected him to say something along the lines of, nah, I just can't hear you. Here's one item, and it's a small one, but I think a good example. The question proposed to him was, presumably, you accept that there's more Linux in businesses than a few years ago. His answer, quote, no, I don't accept that at all, end quote. I think that shows that either he's purposely being deceitful or he's just painfully unaware of reality. Neither are good, in my opinion, for a head of platform strategy. Now, this interview is something I would have expected a couple years ago out of Microsoft, but not today. So many people there have been changing their views and their ideals. And I think whether you like Linux or not, or accept Linux or not, it should be obvious that there is more of it in businesses than a few years ago. Even if it's a small amount overall when compared to, say, what Microsoft sells, it's still more on a comparative level with itself over time, and especially when time is measured in the duration of a few years. It's clear that some people still think Microsoft is invincible, despite thousands of years of human history that categorically tells us that nothing of human origin is invincible. From the greatest of dynasties to the mightiest of companies, everyone has its downfall eventually. Putting your head in the sand and denying that will only bring your demise faster. The next story I have is Oracle to bring Siebel CRM to Linux. Furthering its commitment to Linux, Oracle has announced that the newest version of Siebel CRM will support Linux. From the article, quote, the independent Siebel Systems, bought by Oracle for over $5 billion last year, had not pledged to support Linux. It had, however, worked with IBM to ensure Siebel CRM could work with DB2 database running on Linux. Still, this news is kind of a no-brainer for Oracle watchers. The Redwood Shores, California company has said it has moved the bulk of its internal systems to Linux already. It has also said it is moving its internal CRM system to Siebel. Ergo, Siebel had better run on Linux. A spokeswoman confirmed that the company is now implementing the nascent Siebel 8 CRM internally and that Siebel 8 will support Linux. It is likely Oracle executives will talk about the development at Oracle Open World kicking off October 22nd in San Francisco. End quote. Now, there was no mention of which distribution or distributions will be officially supported, nor was there any further rumors or speculation in the article about the previously talked about Oracle supported or Oracle distribution itself. You'd have to guess at a minimum RHEL and SLES, which is Red Hat Enterprise Linux, and the SUSE Linux Enterprise, will be on the support list. Whether they'll co-announce something in regards to all the rumors that have been swirling about Oracle Linux, who really knows? It's good to see Linux continuing to move up the chain, though, further and further into that enterprise space. Oracle is obviously a huge player in that space, and the fact that they are moving more towards Linux internally says a lot. The next story I have is making sense of the one laptop per child proprietary software rule. There is currently a debate going on between Theo Durrett of OpenBSD and a Red Hat employee about the OLPC choice to use a network driver that does not have open specs available. From the article, quote, Theo Durrett, the leader of the OpenBSD project and vociferous crusader for hardware, especially networking, documentation, recently went public with his concerns about the One Laptop Per Child project's choice to use a wireless networking chip from Marvel, a company with an unusually poor record of supporting free software operating systems, in the 2B1 laptop computer that it is developing. Marvel is unwilling to freely support hardware documentation so that programmers can create device drivers that properly interface with its wireless chips. End quote. And part of the response to that open letter from Jim Geddes is here. Quote, OLPC is dedicated to open source. Our mission, from the beginning, is to make the process as open and transparent as possible, that anyone can air their concerns, misinformed as they may be, long before our system is shipped, reflects this. Our systems won't be produced in volume until late next spring. We are part of the free and open source community ourselves, and we are a nonprofit organization. Our number one priority is to provide laptops to children in developing nations. This brings unique requirements on many aspects of our hardware choice. The Marvel wireless chip is in fact unique in the market at this moment. Many or most of the children in the world do not have electrical power, nor do they have computer networking. Without power being available, even if access points cost nothing, you have no network. So we are deploying mesh networking that allow a child's laptop to forward packets for their friend or neighbor. Each laptop becomes, in effect, a battery-powered access point for others. Even as low power as the AMD Geode is, if it is turned on, it will consume 5 to 10 times the power that the Marvel wireless chip will consume. So, for it to be feasible to have human-powered laptop, essential since a good fraction of the world's children lack electricity, is use a mesh network to connect the kids' machines to each other and often to the internet, so that those children can learn from each other, their teachers, and the world as a whole. End quote. Now, if you're interested in the entire progression of this, the open letter response, and then the retort from Theo, which all are fairly long, I link to them on my blog. Jim also points out that the OLPC system is the first mass-produced system designed in which the BIOS firmware and loader is open, and they're using the Linux BIOS. He also points out that OLPC has gotten AMD to release the code for VSA, which is the virtual system architecture, and that Marvel did actually redesign something to be more standards compliant, and that had to do with the SD interface. Now, I've mentioned OLPC on the podcast previously, and I've been meaning to take a closer look at it for a while now. The general principle is very good, I think, from what I've seen. My main question, and what I really wanted to get into in depth, is what the actual numbers look like, and whether, in my opinion, which I guess doesn't mean much anyway, is if it's a sustainable project that has a realistic chance of making a tangible difference. I'll be digging more into that over the next couple of days. In the meantime, their assertion that, quote, the basic assumption is that education is at the root of any solution, end quote, is very in line with my general doctrine. That alone makes me really like what they're trying to do. The fact that, by its very nature, open source creates a kind of a level playing field, I think makes it a natural fit for a project like this. But what if no hardware for a specific piece of the project is available with open specs, which is what they're saying here? Leaning on the vendor seems like the right thing to do to me, but can you realistically delay the entire project until that lobbying bears fruit? And what if that lobbying never comes to fruition? Do you then hope an open spec device exists soon enough? And what is the value of soon enough? In the end, you need to do what's best to meet the goals for your project. For OLPC, the children are first, and being 100% open is not. Being as open as possible, it would seem, is. In that context, I think this decision does make sense. Theo seems to think that there may be other cards out there that fit the bill and would have been appropriate, but I'll admit that I don't know enough about specific wireless networking chips to be able to comment on that. One side note here that I find interesting is that Theo is not a proponent of pushing for open firmware. And basically, the way this Marvel chipset works is that firmware in a binary form runs on the actual device, and then the driver talks to that firmware. The firmware is not only not open, but it's not freely distributable from a derivative sense of the word, which is where a lot of the problem is coming in here. And here's a quote from Theo. Quote, "Some people, mostly just RMS, insist on firmware source code. We do not feel that we need or even want firmware source code, just the missing binary component that allows the device to operate. Our number one goal is that our users be able to use the devices they've purchased. We feel that when RMS insists on things which vendors will never give, he confuses the vendors and the vendors back off and end up giving us nothing at all. As a result, everyone loses. RMS, the vendors, the operating system suppliers, and the users. This is not yet the time or place to make such strict statements." End quote. That seems to me like an extremely realistic and even-headed statement, which to me is real progress and a sign that the open source community is maturing. Theo traditionally has been pretty much seen to be on the far edge, the fringe, if you will, of the opinion of the open source community. So the fact that he now is being, I think, extremely realistic and making a ton of sense shows how the gauge has swung a little bit. And you can often tell a lot about a community, about what its most vehement people think. So I think this is a good indicator that as a whole, the entire community really is coming of age. And keep in mind here that OpenBSD has had multiple wins in getting specs to write open source drivers, especially as mentioned in that network space. Now, in the end, OLPC is working on a completely open, freely distributable open driver / firmware, so this may all be moot in the end, but I think the conversation is good. And the good news here is that both sides have good intentions while having slightly different goals, and the vigilance and dedication you see on both sides here is a good thing in my opinion. A quick related follow-up to the OLPC in general is that yesterday, it appears the initiative secured its first purchaser. Libya has agreed to provide each and every one of its school children with a laptop. From the article, quote, "The government of Libya is reported to have agreed to provide its 1.2 million school children with a cheap, durable laptop computer by June 2008. The laptops offer internet access and are powered by a wind-up crank. They cost about $100 and manufacturing begins next year, says One Laptop Per Child," end quote. So obviously, it's just great to see a country finally commit to this. I know in the past, tentative purchase agreements or negotiations with Brazil and Argentina, Nigeria, and I think Thailand have been announced, but this is the first concrete, confirmed purchase. There's even talk of the possibility of Libya financing the purchase of laptops for a group of poorer African neighbors, such as Chad, Niger, and Rwanda, were the ones mentioned. Now, Libya has come a long way in the last 10 years or so. While they're still remembered by many as a kind of terrorist state from yesteryear that you don't hear as much about recently, the reality is that these days they have one of the highest standards of living in Africa, I believe the highest human development index in all of Africa, and one of the highest GDPs in Africa. They have an extremely high literacy rate, and I believe free education for everyone, so this definitely fits in well with giving every one of their school children a laptop. And I think a commitment to this initiative shows that Gaddafi is serious about a more open Libya. To me, it's especially surprising that a dictatorship was the first to move forward with the OLPC effort. Education can kind of be a tenuous thing for a dictatorship, basically for fear that a more educated population might rise up against you. And the OLPC has a very real chance to make an educational difference. You know, there's the old proverb that says, "Give a man a fish and he will eat for a day. Teach him how to fish and he will eat for a lifetime." In effect, the OLPC has the potential to teach people how to learn anything, and not only that, it gives them the means to actually do so. That is extremely powerful. The last story I have is Microsoft's shown involvement with Baystar and SCO. It's amazing how long we go between SCO stories these days, isn't it? This article was in Grok Law. Here's a quote. Quote, On page 21 in IBM's amended redacted memorandum in support of its motion for summary judgment on SCO's interference claims, which is SCO's 7th, 8th, and 9th cause of action, IBM reveals that SCO alleged that it was IBM that got Baystar to threaten litigation against SCO and to terminate its business relationship. Baystar denies it, as does IBM. If you noticed a declaration by Larry Goldfarb on the list of exhibits, this is what it's about. He provided a declaration for IBM stating that SCO's allegations are not true. A lot of folks have done so too, and so IBM is now asking the court to toss out all these three SCO claims. Baystar, Goldfarb testifies, dumped SCO because its stock price, financial performance, and the viability of its Unix products all appeared to be in decline, and he was also very concerned about SCO's high cash burn rate. Pure financial animals get nervous when that happens. But the kicker was he began to realize that Microsoft, whose senior VP of corporate development and strategy had promised that Microsoft would in some way guarantee the SCO investment, started to show signs it might not do so after all. Mr. Emerson and I discussed a variety of investment structures wherein Microsoft would backstop or guarantee in some way Baystar's investment. Microsoft assured me that it would in some way guarantee Baystar's investment in SCO. After the investment was made, Goldfarb says, Microsoft stopped returning my phone calls and emails, and to the best of my knowledge, Mr. Emerson was fired from Microsoft. End quote. While various previous leaks had implicated Microsoft in the funding of the SCO charade, and specifically the Baystar involvement, nothing as concrete as this had been released to my knowledge. The ironic part here, of course, is that in the end, it appears this case may have actually helped both Linux and open source. It's given some credence to the GPL when SCO was forced to back down on some of their claims. It spread the word about Linux in places it may not have gotten that exposure otherwise. And it's made IBM and Linux a well-known, well-regarded combo. Even worse for Microsoft, I'd guess that IBM and potentially Novell with some of the other involvement they have in litigation going on with SCO will probably go after Microsoft now. As a monopoly who has already gone through litigation with the Department of Justice, this will be bad for them. Potentially very bad. In a year that it's likely going to see Vista delayed one last time, this is certainly a headache they just don't need. This may actually get more interesting than I'd have thought. That's all I have for now, but thanks for listening.